May it please the Court, and good morning. Stephen Margolin from Ashby & Geddes on behalf of the appellee, M&G Polymers. I rise only to introduce my colleague, Stephen Holman of the Holman Lovells firm, who has been admitted pro hoc and with the Court's permission will be presenting argument today.
Thank you. Welcome to the Court.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Summers Price on behalf of appellant CareStream Health, and I'd like to introduce Myron Kirschbaum, who has been admitted pro hoc vice and will be making the argument on behalf of the appellant today.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to start the clock. When the yellow light comes on, you'll be into the time you reserve. You can continue or ask to reserve whatever's remaining.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Myron Kirschbaum, K. Scholler, LLP, counsel for CareStream Health, Inc., the appellant in this matter. I would like to begin by discussing what was probably the first and perhaps the most costly of the errors that we believe were committed by the court below in connection with this case, and that is the court's ruling pretrial denying CareStream's motion for summary judgment based on the clear language of Section 23 of the supply agreement between the parties, which is appendix page 397, and also followed later by her announcement that she had, in fact, not only denied CareStream's motion for summary judgment in terms of the interpretation of Section 23, but that she meant to grant summary judgment to M&G on their reading of Section 23, therefore taking that issue out of the case, and in effect setting the law on that, that Section 23 as a matter of law does not apply. I'd like to go back to the language of Section 23, which I believe on several grounds is dispositive in our favor. The clause reads, neither party shall be responsible or liable to the other for lost profits or lost business opportunities, or for indirect, special, punitive, or consequential damages arising out of or in connection with supply of goods provided for in this agreement, or for the termination of the agreement as provided for herein.
Well, didn't the Superior Court say that the difference in this case is there was a breach? Wasn't that the court's rationale?
The court's rationale was that supply should be read to mean only if goods were supplied in actuality and only to the extent they were, and that it should not include claims such as the claims in this case, which are clearly in connection with, that arise from and are in connection with, the supply of goods provided for in this agreement. This agreement does, the agreement doesn't say that the clause applies only to goods that were provided pursuant to the agreement. The supply of goods must be provided for in the agreement. And we submit, and we argued this below in a four-page brief, which was all we were allowed on the motion, but we submit that this claim and this case is all about the supply of goods provided for in this agreement. That's what it's about. It's about whether or not the goods that were supplied, and there were some goods that were supplied, it's about whether the goods that were supplied were qualified for in the use of our machine. And then it's also about whether we were obligated, therefore, to accept further supply of goods, all of which would be provided for in the agreement if they were, in fact, proper goods.
Well, what we're dealing with, I gather, is an interpretation of a contract governed by New York law.
True.
And you're claiming that the court erred the court erroneously misinterpreted the critical language, and therefore the damages award would have to be reversed. What is the precise legal issue framed in terms of the contract language that we're being asked to decide here?
Well, it is a legal issue as to whether or not the plain meaning of the language in the clause precludes our argument as a matter of law. That was a decision that the court made as a matter of law, that the plain meaning rule precludes our argument, and also that it does not justify or validate our argument. So those are both issues of law. The issues of New York law or New York jurisprudence that I think come into play are several, one of which is represented in the Duane Reed case, which we have cited to the court. The Duane Reed case is an appellate division decision.
Sir, are you saying, I understand your statement of the issue. Now, are you saying they're sub-issues or they're just legal arguments?
There are issues of New York law that I believe apply to the proper interpretation of the clause. The legal issue is the meaning of the clause. Where New York law does play a role here, because other plain meaning is plain meaning in Delaware as well as in New York, but where I believe New York law does play a role, and we've cited the case on that, Duane Reed, is that New York has what is referred to by the appellate division as the last antecedent rule. And the last antecedent rule, as applied to this language, we believe, actually totally vitiates the whole issue of whether or not this claim arises out of or in connection with the supply of goods. Because as applied to this clause, the last antecedent rule would require that this clause be read as follows. Neither party shall be responsible or liable to the other for lost profits or lost business opportunities, or for indirect, special, punitive, or consequential damages, no comma, arising out of or in connection with supply of goods provided for under this agreement, or for termination of the agreement as provided for herein. You have three clauses there, three separate clauses separated by the word each time, separated by the word for. Under the last antecedent rule, the language provided for under the language that says arising out of or in connection with supply of goods should only apply to that clause. It doesn't apply to the clause afterwards. No one argues that it would. And it shouldn't apply to the prior clause, which would be the lost profits clause. So our argument is twofold. One, we believe that this claim in this case does in fact arise out of or in connection with, which is a broad phrase, in connection with supply of goods provided for under this agreement. Again, the goods need not be actually provided as long as the supply of goods is provided for in the agreement, which it is. That's argument number one. Argument number two is that even if the court were right in the way she read arising out of or in connection with the supply of goods, that language under the Duane Reed case applies only to the middle of the three prepositions in this clause, only to indirect, special, or punitive or consequential damages arising out of or in connection with, not lost business opportunities, which are separately stated, separated from indirect, special, punitive, or consequential damages. So we believe under both of those arguments, we should have gotten summary judgment, and they should not have gotten summary judgment. The other New York law issue that we've raised, which M&G completely ignored as far as I could recall or as far as I saw in their briefs, was the Metropolitan Life case, which we cited from the New York Court of Appeals. And the Metropolitan Life case, which is 643 Northeast 2nd 504, that sets forth a rule of interpretation by the New York Court of Appeals. And the rule of interpretation is that as between two parties, when a limitation of liability clause is at issue, as it was in Metropolitan Life, that to the extent possible, the interpretation should be in accordance with a symmetry, a principle of symmetry, equality of treatment of both parties. It should not be assumed in a limitation of liability clause that the limitation of liability only works in favor of one party and not the other. Now here, Section 23 begins with the word, neither party shall be liable. So the principle of reciprocity and symmetry is enshrined in the language of Section 23. But in addition, we have the interpretive guideline of Metropolitan Life that says courts should strive, if at all possible, to interpret limitation of liability clauses as applying equally to both parties. The court below, the way the court below interpreted Section 23, the freedom from lost profits damages, or for that matter, consequential or indirect or punitive damages, is only a one-way street. Because if one were to take the court's reading, the lower court's reading of the clause, it only protects if goods are actually supplied, meaning, of course, that something's wrong with the goods. If goods are not accepted, which would normally be the case if you're talking about a claim against the buyer, then the court reads the clause totally out of the contract, as applied to lost profits, lost business opportunities, or indirect consequential or punitive damages. So that, in addition to the fact the words neither party kind of jump out at you, and indicate that that kind of asymmetrical reading was not intended here. In addition to that, you have the Metropolitan Life case, which comes along and says just the opposite, that if anything, you're supposed to tilt in favor of establishing reciprocity and applying the limitation of liability on both sides of the ledger. And what the court did here was just totally throw that on its head and interpret this clause, ignoring the words neither party, completely ignoring those words, and making this a totally one-way street. So both on the plain language and plain meaning rule, both on the wording of the clause itself, and with the interpretive aid of Metropolitan Life, we believe the court was in error and that as a result, summary judgment should have been granted in our favor and certainly not in favor of M&G. I'd like, if it's all right with the court, to go on to our next argument, which deals with the calculation of damages here, other than, even assuming that lost profits could somehow be allowed. And if lost profits are out of the case, the damage award is substantially reduced. But even if lost profits were to be allowed, we believe that the court's rulings, in a number of ways, turned this case into a case that was at least 7 or 8 times greater in terms of the magnitude of the damage exposure than it was intended to be or should have been. We had a contract here, which was a 4-year contract. The court allowed the plaintiff's damage expert to testify as to 7 years of lost profits. In addition, we had a clause in our contract which provided for the possibility of meeting competition. And this became an issue later on and a hotly contested issue in a number of ways. But as applied to damages, what that meant was M&G had, and they've said this themselves, they negotiated for a 1-year price protection period. It was 1 year in which they were going to be able to have the price. They were going to be able to have the price that they set. And actually, it would be less than a year because under Appendix B of the supply agreement, it would only be the portion of that year in which they were actually qualified. And I'm putting aside now the liability issue as to whether they ever were qualified, because we don't believe they ever got qualified. But even putting aside the liability issue, they were only entitled to price protection for that 1 year. In effect, what their expert assumed, and what their expert was allowed to argue to M&G was allowed to argue to the jury, and we believe the jury was actually even misled here by the instructions, was that M&G should be able to recover 7 full years of lost profits on a contract in which they had only negotiated for less than 1 year of price protection. They were able to recover 7 years worth of profits, not one. How did they do that? First, as a result of being allowed to claim profits for a 3-year period of time after the 4-year term of the agreement would have expired. We believe that that was wrong as a matter of law. We've cited case law to that effect. And that is simply putting a party in a better position as a result of a breach than that party would have been in if the contract had been provided, had been fulfilled, which is anathema in terms of damages theory in contract cases. The idea of damages in contract cases is that a party is not to be put in a better position than it would have been in had there been performance. Performance here was 4 years. The court granted, as I said, the court allowed M&G to argue and get damages for more than a 4-year period of time. Second of all, on this issue of meat competition, the judge gave an instruction, a very clear, forthright instruction, that as a matter of fact, the meat competition clause that there had been no meat competition offer in this case. That was based on the court's this determination that the contract did not permit meeting competition in 2007, only permitted meeting competition in 2008, and by 2008 there was no longer a contract. There was no longer a relationship between these parties. They were in litigation. So the court said, okay, no meeting competition. There's been no valid meeting competition in this case. Well, for purposes of damages, that was not necessarily true, because even granting the court's determination, which we're not appealing from, that there was no meeting competition for 2007, there was nothing to stop Carestream from invoking the meat competition clause in 2008 and thereafter. And in fact, of course, much of the case and much of the trial had to do with the fact that Carestream had another supplier that was in fact offering a better price. when the court gave its instruction and said, well, there's been no meat competition offer in this case, Carestream's counsel raised the fact, but for purposes of damages, Your Honor, the meat competition clause should be taken into account. The court did not recognize that, would not recognize that in her instructions to the jury. Therefore, the jury was given an instruction, a blanket instruction, that said there has been no meat competition in this case. And we believe that was misleading to the jury and prevented the jury from considering the effect of the evidence. And although there were many objections and many exclusions, we did manage to get evidence into the record that there was a possibility of meeting competition for future years. The court's instruction, however, we believe precluded that. Next point I'd like to just touch upon. Oh, am I into my yellow period?
Yeah, 2 seconds.
Okay. Then I'll just use a little bit of my rebuttal time to just say this. The court erred by excluding from evidence highly pertinent evidence about what we call the December run. A lot of the case here had to do with whether or not the testing that had gone on of the M&G material in the summer of 2007, whether that had been a successfully run test or not. M&G had an expert who testified to a scientific certainty that the conditions that were arrived at in the August test would have continued to allow the rosin to run without incident indefinitely, and that was his word, indefinitely.
The trial court basically found as fact that this December run was not intended as in any way as a qualification of the M&G product to operate in the Colorado plant. What is the legal argument given that this whole issue of what the December run was all about was factual, and the facts were not only found against your client, but devastatingly against your client?
The fact of the matter is, Your Honor, that the issue is not whether or not there was an accreditation trial or not. We didn't really claim that that was the intention of that run, was to test the material. What we simply argued was that the fact was that the material was run and the results were highly unsuccessful. That, therefore, casts...
Highly unsuccessful in relation to what? This was designed basically to burn off this material to get it out of your client's inventory.
It was designed
so,
to...
So why should the jury be hearing it? It bears no relationship to any issue in the case. And even if it did, as the court found, the risk of misleading the jury would outweigh whatever logical relevance it might have.
I would just... close with this, Your Honor, to save what remaining rebuttal I have. The point of the evidence would have been to show that the scientific certainty expressed by M&G's experts about the success of the August trial was way, way overblown, and that the exact same problem could, in fact, arise again and was not solved by the testing that was done in the summer.
Wasn't the Superior Court also influenced by the letter from the attorney that for your client that said the December run was irrelevant?
She mentioned that, and all I can say about that is that although that letter was written about a year before trial, that all of the discovery that took place after that letter, they wrote that letter was written, but the discovery was provided, depositions were taken on both sides, the experts on both sides opined on the December run. M&G moved in limine to eliminate the evidence of the December run. So everybody knew that despite the fact that early on in discovery this objection had been raised, the case was tried not on that basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Justice Holland, you're exactly right, and I'd like to start in the last argument and then work my way backwards. Carestream's statement in its own counsel's letter, not a year, but 6 months before trial, February 19, 2009, we disagree that the December 2009 trial is relevant because that trial occurred after M&G declared Carestream Health in breach of the contract. Their words quoted verbatim, and the Brywell argument was not even raised until post-trial motions. It was not raised as part of the briefing before trial. That argument was waived, and rightly so, and the trial judge correctly ruled. I'd also like to address the facts surrounding the meat competition issue because I think they're highly relevant to a number of the issues that were raised at trial and to the court's chagrin at the way the trial was being conducted in light of the late produced documents and chagrin at some of the defenses that were produced. And specifically, yes, the court did not broadly prohibit the arguing of a meat competition reduction in connection with the damage. In fact, Mr. Riley, M&G's damages expert, was cross-examined at great length on that issue, and Carestream's trial counsel argued it in closing. So it was not a prohibition. The court simply read and gave effect to its summary judgment rulings on the facts that a meat competition offer meeting the requirements of Section 13.2 of the contract was never properly made. And it turned out that that ruling was exactly correct based on documents that were produced very late in the trial, and specifically one document that's at tab 61 of M&G's record, it's B787, that was found to have been improperly withheld on grounds of an erroneously asserted work product privilege. It was a Todd Arndorfer document created in July 30, 07. Mr. Arndorfer testified on the stand that litigation was the farthest thing from his mind until he received M&G's trial counsel's letter on August 13th. That document compares the specification of M&G's product with the specification of Eastman's product, the only product that was ever raised as a potentially competing product, and it concludes, simply stated, ECC pre-poly is not comparable to M&G polymer. ECC pre-polymer does not meet these M&G specifications. It obviously does not meet the pellet consistency because it is a powder, not a pellet.
May I interrupt you there? I'm misunderstanding, but as I heard opposing counsel, it was not an argument that during the time that this contract arguably was being fulfilled, there had not been an appropriate meet and beat, whatever the term is, meet competition submitted. We're all perhaps in agreement that that didn't happen during the time that the parties were operating under the contract. However, when you're trying to determine what damages there are, if after 1 year, as I understand the contract, there would be the option of presenting such an alternative price and then requiring the other side to either meet that price or withdraw from the contract, then shouldn't that be a part of the way future damages are calculated, as opposed to simply assuming that there will never be any other competitive bid from another supplier?
Well, I would say the trial court did not instruct that there never would be a potential competition from other suppliers, and it was open to Carestream to argue based on the structure of the market and identified competitors in the market that there was someone else available manufacturing a pellet with the same specifications and a comparable product that had the capacity to meet the demand, because that was part of the requirement of 13.2, and that such a meat competition offer, had it been made in 2008 or afterwards, might have affected the price and might have created price erosion, which would have dropped the profit that M&G was contending to receive. And in fact, what Mr. Riley, M&G's damages expert, stated was that he took that into account in connection with the discount that he applied for years farther and farther out under contract performance. So he did take that into account in a general way. My issue is there was no specifically identified competitor who might have been able to meet to make a competitive demand that would have given rise to an effective 13.2 offer. The only competitor that was offered up as a possibility was ECC, and indeed what Carestream asserted for the jury was that we made an offer in 2007, but what we told M&G was that it wouldn't become effective until 2008. It couldn't have made an offer with respect to ECC resin even in 2008 because it had concluded internally that ECC's resin was not a qualified product that to which 13.2 could apply. So the whole meat competition issue, I would say, based on the facts as they came out at trial, both the facts that the court and the jury were aware of and the facts that came out after trial, was a red herring, nor did the trial judge err in her instruction in regard to that
issue.
So
just to summarize and make sure that I understand you correctly, you're saying that there was nothing to preclude the argument that future profits would be significantly diminished because there could be another meat competition presented that would have to be honored.
Based on a hypothetical
right.
Meat comp offer that might be offered in 2008 or afterwards, but M&G argued that, to the jury that there was that was very speculative because
right.
there was...
Okay. Yeah, yeah, I'm not concerned about that.
So, just to follow up on Justice Berger's question, CareStream wasn't precluded from arguing the impact, whatever it might be, of the meat competition on the issue of how damages should be measured. And moreover, that issue, they did have an opportunity to litigate it, but at the end, their proof fell short. Is that your
exactly
point?
Exactly so, Justice Jacobs. With respect to the applicability of Section 23, the limitation of liability provision, Justice Holland, I think you are exactly right in focusing on the fact that what distinguishes this situation from that clause is that here we have a breach. From the party's very language, they constructed the clause.
Well, my question was, wasn't that the focus of the Superior Court's opinion when the Superior Court distinguished Section 23?
It was one focus of the trial court's opinion, and properly so, because the termination section of Section 23 refers not to a termination by breach, but to a termination in accordance with the provisions of this agreement. So a proper termination, a non-breach situation. But that's not the only reason that the court was correct in ruling as a matter of law that Section 23 unambiguously doesn't apply in this situation. The contract sets up two parallel sets of obligations, and this is nowhere more evident than on page one of the contract itself, which appears in the record at A384, it's CareStream's tab 36. And there are four separate references on that page alone, the first page of the contract, in the second recital, in the definition section, in the scope section, section 2.2, and in the quantity section, section 3.0. which delineate between the set of obligations pertaining to the supplier's obligation to supply and a completely different set of obligations, which is the purchaser's obligation to purchase. So there are two sets of contractual obligations at play in connection with this negotiated arrangement, and the sets that is implicated by the language in Section 23 is the supply of goods, meaning the supplier's obligations. So Section 23 applies in cases, in two sets of cases, cases involving the supply of goods and cases involving a termination in accordance with this agreement, not to the entire purchaser-supplier relationship, and it does not create a categorical bar that applies under all circumstances to prevent a supplier from recovering its direct and foreseeable damages in consequence of a breach, which is exactly what M&G was trying to do here. The grammatical, with deference to my counsel across the aisle, the argument about antecedents and about a single for is what we refer to in our brief as a schoolmarmish grammarian's approach that elevates grammar over logic. It also ignores, as a grammatical fact, the first comma that follows for lost profits, which suggests that it's one in a series of enumerated instances where those damages would not be available. To read it as Mr. Kirschbaum would read it, that comma should have been moved to follow or for lost business relationships. Instead, the comma comes only after the four lost profits, suggesting it's part of a continuing series.
But your broader argument is that the whole notion of supplier's obligation and the reference to that, the term supply in Section 23 can't be read in a vacuum. That is, it has to be read outside the four corners of Section 23 because there is a meaningful distinction made elsewhere in the contract between suppliers and purchasers' obligations. Is that
exactly right? And we submit that if you read the clause in the context of the entire relationship and read the contract as a whole, then Mr. Kirschbaum's offered reading makes no sense. And it particularly makes no sense because there's no explanation why you would categorically bar a lost profits recovery, but would only bar a recovery for indirect, special, or consequential damages in two enumerated situations, nor does Carestream offer any logical reason why the parties would have drawn such a curious distinction through their contract negotiations.
Can I interrupt there? How do you interpret the start of that section that says neither party? As I understand your argument, this section really doesn't apply to both parties.
Well, I think it could apply to both parties, particularly in regard to termination in accordance with this agreement, which really protects the rights of Carestream. In a situation where Carestream terminated, and for example, if M&G had goods in flow or goods in transit to Carestream at the point of termination that hadn't been accepted yet, M&G can't claim for consequential damages as a result of a proper termination in accordance with the terms of the agreement under those circumstances. So I believe there is a symmetry, and more broadly, there's a symmetry in the larger business relationship between the two parties. Carestream was obtaining the benefit of reserve capacity and an enforceable commitment to supply, and what M&G was getting back in the bargain for exchange was an enforceable commitment to sell.
Mr. Holman, one of the arguments that's made, and it's really the damages consequence of the lost profits issue, is that even if your side's construction of Section 23 is correct, and lost profits are recoverable as part of a claim for direct damages, that it was error to permit a recovery for 7 years of lost profits when the contract itself ran out after 4 years. What is your side's response to that?
Well, we believe those renewal damages are direct recoverable damages. They're part of the party's foreseeable business arrangement. And here's what I mean by that. There was testimony from M&G's representatives and from its expert in connection with the long-term infrastructure changes that M&G made in anticipation of a longer-term relationship. That is, the contribution to the installation of the grinding equipment at the Kodak Colorado facility, and infrastructure changes within M&G's own plants in order to meet the capacity obligations it was undertaking, and tooling this performance chemical to the specific requirements of Carestream, all of which took great investment, a significant undertaking of time and resources, and which M&G said they did in anticipation of a long-term relationship with what was then.
So your point is that there was evidence to support a jury finding that the plaintiff had that there was a reasonable expectation of a renewal of the contract?
Exactly right. There was a factual predicate for that assumption by the expert, and as an economic matter, as the expert testified, when you're in a business relationship, it's more probable than outside of a business relationship that you'll secure a renewal of that existing business relationship, and the anticipation of that renewal has an economic value, which is lost here when the contract is terminated early. And that's why those renewal damages were properly supported by factual testimony, and it was not erroneous to permit the jury to consider them. The same is true with the volume damages that
CareStream. Excuse me, one moment. Just sticking with that point, was the issue litigated before the jury of whether or not that the possibility of renewal was speculative? That is, was there argument to the jury that it should that any evidence of that sort was speculative and it should ignore?
Certainly, that was a significant basis for the cross examination that Mr. Yesowicz conducted of Mr. Riley during his expert testimony. The assumption of a renewal. And the assumption of a 100% volume purchase, despite the fact that the contract, by its terms, only appeared to require 90%. It allowed more, but it didn't require more. But we have Mr. Morabito's trial testimony on the volume point, and what Mr. Morabito testified to twice in the space of three pages, I believe it's at B401 and 403 of our record, was that I would buy 100% from them if they would meet my price and quality requirements, and they turned me down flat. He said that twice in his testimony. So there's a factual basis for the assumption. In addition, there was testimony that it was the anticipation of the parties, Kodak and M&G at the time they contracted, that Kodak wanted to turn to a single source of supply as it had been doing with Eastman, but it wanted the supply to be of pellets, not of powder. So it had enjoyed a single source of supply arrangement with Eastman for 30 years. It was now moving to a different manufacturer. Given the requirements of qualifying that manufacturer, given the time it took to ensure that the resin met the specifications, given the time to negotiate the arrangement, there was every expectation that that CareStream would meet all of its volume requirements directly from M&G and not from a third-party supplier. So again, there was an adequate factual predicate for that issue to go to the jury.
Does the contract have any provision in it for a right to renew, assuming the product is being supplied in accordance with the requirements of its quality?
There's no explicit right to renew under the terms of the contract. I mean, it was certainly possible for the person.
I guess what I'm getting at is that I hear you when you say that there had been a past relationship with a supplier that lasted 30 years and that it would be appropriate to assume that CareStream was going to continue to use one supplier for the indefinite future, but this was the first contract, was it not, with a slightly different product that may or may not have been entirely satisfactory to CareStream, correct? I mean, assuming even that there was no breach.
That's all correct.
Okay. So how do you get from that point to saying, but we assume that this contract would have been reinstituted at full volume or renewed at full volume for another 4 years or 3 years, whatever.
I believe the assumption was not at the full contract volume under Mr. Riley's calculation, but the assumption of renewal, again, was founded on the testimony of the parties and the documents suggesting that they intended for this to be a longer-term relationship than merely the 4 years that the contract covered. So there was every expectation that the parties, like M&G had done with other customers, would continue the relationship beyond the contract term. I see that my time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. I'd like to go back to Section 23 for a moment. Section 23, and I understand that they were the supplier and we were the purchaser, yes. But Section 23 doesn't talk about suppliers and purchasers. Never says when suppliers are going to be liable. Never says when purchasers are going to be liable. The only reference to the parties in Section 23 are the first two words of Section 23. Neither party shall be responsible. or liable to the other. And then it lists the circumstances in which neither party would be responsible one to the other. No differentiation is made in any of those situations between suppliers and purchasers. The only qualification is yes, as far as the middle clause is concerned, the reference to indirect or indirect or special damages, that the damages must be in connection with supply of goods provided for under the agreement. And as I've argued before, we believe this was in connection with the supply of goods provided for under the agreement. As far as being school marmish, I plead guilty. I've always been a school marm, but I will just say in my defense that the appellate division in New York, in the first department, in the Duane Reade case, which I cited before, provides that as applied to the to a contract, this doctrine, referring to the last antecedent doctrine, which is what we are citing, becomes essentially an application of English language grammar. Yes, English language grammar counts in the interpretation of a contract provision, and I think if the court parses this language, I believe it will see that we are dealing with three separate circumstances, and only one of those is qualified by arising out of or in connection with supply of goods.
So your argument is that even if you are school mommers, so is the appellate division.
Apparently the appellate division and the First Department are as equally school mommers. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will take a brief recess.